Welcome to the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast. I'm Sean Bostrock. Today, we're joined by Jordan Thistlewood, Chief Innovation Officer at Cook Optics, where he leads the company's push into the future of cinematography at the intersection of lenses, metadata, and digital workflows. With more than 25 years' experience across photography, VFX, animation, virtual production, and software for creative industries, Jordan has helped shape the tools and pipelines behind modern visual storytelling. From his leadership roles at Foundry, to driving virtual production product strategy at Epic Games, and now building the Cook digital ecosystem. At Cook, he's focused on bringing cinematographers, VFX artists, animators, and game creators into a shared community, and developing the next generation of optical and digital tools that keep the cinematographer's vision at the center of increasingly complex production workflows. Jordan, welcome to the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Good to see you. I want to start by asking you about you. Just tell us a bit about what you do, where you're from, how you got to where you are now.
Okay. I'll try and keep that as brief as possible. I started off... I would say in a sort of an academic pathway in terms of like, you know, sort of education, things like that. But I was always drawn to more technical aspects, which then started to find their way into creative aspects, which then really sort of focused around, I'd say, photography, which I think is this beautiful blend of both the art, the craft, the technology, the science. And long story short, I ended up doing a bachelor's in fine arts and drama, but focused on lighting and set design. But then at the same time, I was also exposed to a very early stage multimedia lab that then sort of allowed me to start exploring those things and those sort of that creative and technical discipline through the technology, which then fortunately transpired into being graduating at the right time to get into the animation and visual effects business, just as it was taking off in the late 90s. I mean, it had been going on for a while, but I joined it just at like one of the big surges. Then that led to a number of years working in visual effects and animation across different projects that then saw me move my family to London, moving more into the business and the technology side. My career had developed in a way where I was focused on building out technologies that help people accomplish their jobs, and that became the sort of penultimate step of helping people across the globe by working with somebody that was making the technology that was being used. And then I had a bit of a pivot into virtual production. So that's the sort of LED walls as are being sort of made famous by The Mandalorian. And then finally found myself at Cook Optics. And so there I'm currently the Chief Innovation Officer. So looking at what is the intersection of optics and digital and what's going to come up next, and just how do we basically service cinematographers at the at across a whole range of uses.
So what is it, I mean, what is a day look like for Chief Innovation Officer?
It's a varied set of things. It's talking with cinematographers to try and understand what are their needs. I mean, like, lenses have been around for, you know, over 100 years. So it's trying to understand what are the current demands that can be answered. And sometimes that's just a different creative aesthetic. Sometimes it's the how can you take this thing that's this big and shrink it down to something this big, because that's the way that things are going with the way cameras are being moved. So as this camera shrinking, it's also looking at computational photography and opportunities that come up with that. And then other parts of it are just reviewing the work that the teams are doing on the digital front, looking at what we have in the way of an optical roadmap, and looking at what people are doing on the development of new cameras and trying to get my head wrapped around that as much as possible.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've spoken about innovation, but Cook has a history. It goes back to 1893, roughly. And obviously started as an analog thing.
Yes.
And iconic films, including The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
Do the cooked lenses have a particular kind of feel to them? I mean, can you tell what, is there a cooked look, so to speak?
The cooked look is like a sort of branded statement about the overall look. I think the way that you could boil it down too is that there's several cooked looks depending on the lens series and when they were created. They all have somewhere between a very characterful vintage kind of feel to them. Some are more clean and clinical. Some have a more of like a commercial beauty look to them. But there are common threads to them all in terms of what wavelengths of light are biased and how we treat skin tones and things like that. So cooked are known for being very warm and good for all skin tones, and therefore like a very human first look.
So to a layman, what is that? You know, how would you interpret that to somebody who knows nothing about cinematography?
I boil it down to it's every lens has a color cast or color opinion, right? And it comes down to the coatings that are on the glass itself, the combinations of those things. Some lenses might skew towards the green and therefore have better representation in of landscape. Some are going to be cooler or more neutral. And it's about the relationship between how the colors are then represented. And for Cook, it's just, we like to emphasize skin tones for across all ethnicities. And that in itself puts people, which are usually the subject of most films, front and center. It puts them in a very naturalistic look, and it helps draw people into those stories.
Right. So how would the visual change? So if you're looking at, I don't know, historical films, like if you're looking at the Wizard of Oz, or if you're looking at Apocalypse Now, I think you also did all the President's Men. Were those?
Yeah, that rings a bell.
So what is the, I mean, these might be silly questions. What is the difference in what you see based on the lens for a movie like that or Wes Anderson, Wes Anderson movie, which is very saturated, isn't it? It's very bright.
Right.
Well, that's not saturated.
I think the, what is important to understand is how has the film production process changed over the years.
Yeah.
So, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, Roger Deakins' first film to then go through a digital color grade. Prior to that, the process being much more built around what chemical combinations were used and how was the film treated, and then red, green, and blue lights dialing in the overall darkness and light of the film print in combination with the chemical processing. So the lens then having more of an impact on the finished image because you have this very broad strokes process. When you get into the digital age, starting with Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, the fact that you then had this digital intermediate process, which is now available to everybody, which I think is fantastic. You look at things like DaVinci Resolve, Final Cut Pro, Adobe Premiere, all of them have these technologies where the use of color and it's the ability to fine tune its look relative to the lens is now at a completely different level in terms of the nuance that color can be sort of manipulated and used to tell the story. But it comes back to the lenses part is, what is that first pass, right? Light hitting the lens through to the sensor. And that first opinion that the cinematographer then influences it with, it starts with that. You would imagine that the technologies would allow skin tones, things like that, to be corrected, but it's also what amount of effort and how's that relationship and what steps have to be taken to reach the same opinion.
So pre-digital, mm-hmm. how complex, I mean, this might be too much of a question, how complex was the kind of the grading process?
I will give you my impression of it, yeah. having never been personally involved in
right.
it.
The only reason I'm asking is because there's obviously been a huge yeah. jump through this, the implementation of digital filtering or processing. Yeah. To achieve probably different results to what you'd be able to achieve, in analog filmmaking. I don't know. I'm making all this up.
No, well, I think you got to look back at through the techniques yeah. of if you think about early optical compositing, holdout mats, things like that. Could you get into on a very specific use case the manipulation of segments of an image?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Would that technique have been a viable technique to approach from a color grading standpoint or timing, as they called it? No, I don't think so. So I think the difference is you had broad strokes. So your lighting, your composition, your scenic design, there were different tools that had to be used to pull that off. And I think lighting was a big, big, big part of that. Yeah. Lenses were then the first sort of way that you kind of made your first opinion, and then lighting was the thing that came through it. So I think it's down to the nuance of when you reach a point where you can automatically track a person's face, and then you can isolate the eyes, and then you can dial in their iris color, and you can do that at scale across 1,200 to 2,000 shots. That's a whole level of nuance and creative expression that you can go through that you wouldn't be able to have gone through in the traditional color timing process.
So you wouldn't have been able to do that at all, really?
I think if somebody had the desire to, they probably could have figured it out, but I just don't think it would have been practical to achieve it.
Right.
So you think,
yeah. No, so that's made a huge, that's had a huge impact.
Absolutely. So I think the scope of what's possible in film production, I know everybody sort of thinks a lot about, and is talking a lot about AI right now, but if you're thinking just about, if you look in the span of a few decades where we've come to now from where we were at, it's evolved immensely.
I'm interested in in this idea of how the industry's changed, because it's obviously changed a lot. And the film about the submarine that I came to the viewing of?
The Commandante, yes.
The Commandante. I mean, not really fully understanding what was going on, but having an appreciation for the use of a digital twin lens.
Yes, so that was an interesting one in that what that offered the filmmakers was the opportunity where normally when you have green screen and blue screen production, you've got the logistics around the blue screen and the green screen. Mm. It's not impossible when you have those to then replace the background and see something else. But the significance was that this was a movie that was taking place and filmed mainly at night. Dark side, no chroma materials, no green screen, no blue screen, and that they were able to preview for the director what the shots would look like after they had gone through the visual effects process very quickly. So the challenge in film production and anything that's related to visual effects is that because the technology and the workflows require a lot of people and a lot of labor, the challenge is you've got like five key creative people on set who are making a lot of choices. Then you have the visual effects supervisor that's working with that team, and they then have to communicate all that creative intent and logistical challenges to however many companies they've hired. Could be five, could be 20.
Yeah.
Then those companies have their own chain of command that starts with the visual effects supervisor of the project down to their department heads, to their leads, and to the artists. So the loop that a director normally goes through is that there will have been some work done in pre-production, there'll be some agreements on what they're trying to achieve, But whether or not they captured the right seed, you know, on set in terms of what they filmed, to then have it go through that process and grow into the finished product that they want, goes through this process of communicating from basically those 5 people to maybe 2,000 people, and then has to come back around, and then the director goes, I think that's what I wanted, or that's not what I wanted, or that's exactly what I wanted, or I changed my mind. Mm. And then, so what you saw with the Commandante was a process whereby a range of technologies came together with a group of people, whereby the director could see what the likely outcome of the visual effects process was going to be before they wrapped shooting that day.
Right.
Even before, as he called cut, somebody could be processing on that, which gives, I think, a level of freedom to that director being very confident that they've made the choices that they want. Everybody can agree on what the finished product is supposed to look like. And then it shortens the whole production process. Basically, that project was really about technology enabling a film to be made at a level that would not have been feasible in budget and schedule any other way.
Right. So, I mean, that's quite a shift then.
Yes.
And is that becoming much more of a kind of a way to work now?
Yes, but I'd still say it's still in a fledgling state. The challenge for the film industry is that there are a lot of great, smart people that sit within their discipline, and typically pre-production, production, and post-production, and sometimes there's still gaps in there. And so communication is the big area. And that's where a lot of our digital side comes in, is helping be the conduit for that communication.
But then what impact does that then have on the skills gaps, if there are? There must be skills gaps then.
Absolutely. I wouldn't say that there's skills gaps. There's career opportunities.
Or career opportunities.
And you and I have talked about this a bit before. And that,
yes.
There are new roles when you have new technology enabled. There is the use of pre-visualization. And that reaching levels of autonomy. So instead of it being like full-blown companies, production teams having access to talented individuals that can kind of have one foot in both worlds of the technology and the filmmaking to be that bridge, to work through that through. And again, it's the confidence that when you're going on to set and you're spending $100,000 or more a day, are you taking a guess at what you're getting? Are you getting coverage so you hope you kind of have it? Or do you know exactly the picture you want to make, and therefore you just have your requirements list and maybe you get a couple extra things? And sometimes that's the difference between a project being viable for its budget and schedule and a project not being done.
What are the, what are the challenges you face now with this, with the introduction of...
That's such a meaty question. I think a lot of it is education and awareness. And things like, if we want to sort of step into the concept of the topic of like production metadata. And this is things like, what was the camera and lens doing at any one point in time for every frame? It's a pretty technical, nerdy conversation. It has really high value, but if it has no, if it doesn't make somebody's, let me take a step back here. If the person that is required to take the steps to protect the capture of that information, if their day doesn't benefit from that, then there has to be a real understanding of, I have a comrade or a peer somewhere else in this process that I can enable or protect by the capture of that information. And because the two processes of post-production and production are usually siloed from each other, I'd say that the biggest challenge right now is making those connections so everybody understands themselves. And I think we've come through a time period of, with COVID and the strikes, that there is actually a really I think, open mindset to everybody wants to improve how things are done for the sake of making it easier to do more with smaller budgets, which is the state that we're in.
If I wanted a lens made specifically for a film that I was shooting, is that what, I mean, do directors come to you and say, listen, I'm filming, I'm shooting or whatever, could you make a custom lens for this because it needs to, it needs to do particular things?
Doesn't really fit into our wheelhouse. I think it's an engaging, fun, exciting topic. But what we try and do at Cook is more about creating really high-quality lenses that are available en masse anywhere in the globe. So if a cinematographer has a shoot in three different countries on two different continents, and they need to be able to access that type of lens in each of those places, our role is to create, really high-end lenses that have a consistency so that they can find them anywhere. When it comes to a customized lens, there's great companies. I mean, there's Panavision, which is sort of the very historic company. There's a great little company called Zero Optic. They do fantastic custom short-run lenses, and it's just they're geared for it, right? We're geared for how do we provide lenses to the world. Therefore, it's not something that we do.
So what is the process? I mean, the lenses are made in the UK, aren't they?
Yes.
And so what is the process? I mean, how do you make a lens? Do you know?
I mean, I haven't been hands-on in ground the glass and things like that myself. But there are very many craftspeople that I've had the pleasure of meeting at HQ that do this. It starts with understanding what is the lens that you want to make. There's about seven different aberrations that are kind of curated. Then when the target is set for what the lens needs, the image that the lens needs to create and the focal lengths we want to use and, things like the T-stop and all those sort of inputs, it goes through our optical design team and then they work out what is the best path. And again, if you think about lens sort of production, it's a bit like plasticine in that you only have so much and you can stretch everything in different directions. And so if you want to like make something, super high performance, well, that's going to stretch in the direction. If you want to make it small and compact, but also really high performance, that starts to stretch in a different direction. So you have these things that are your sort of dimensions of sort of control. And then once the optics are figured out from a design standpoint, it goes through the mechanical design process. And then it goes into the manufacturing, prototyping, building things up, and then eventually into a production run.
And that production run could be one or 10 or however many.
It depends on the lens series. I mean, some have sold, thousands around the world over the years, and some for like a very sort of niche high end will be less than that.
So, and how do you become a lens maker?
Well, I don't know. I don't have a time machine, so I can't really go back and ask.
I'm thinking about you. You mentioned the craftsman.
Yes.
And I was wondering what you.
Okay.
Know.
No. I think. All right. I was thinking more like the broad company.
Right.
No, I think it's a craft skill. I think it's people that enjoy a meticulous process, putting on headphones and kind of just zoning out and kind of getting into it. And so I think it would be the same thing about just someone become a watchmaker. Similar skill set in terms of dealing with all the little nuanced steps and building things together.
See, we've come to luxury by default.
Yeah. There you go. Happy to provide the segue.
The crafts thing is obviously really interesting to me because there's so few people in the world today who really focus on this idea of craft. But in certain industry like yours, you need that.
Well, absolutely. And I think we were talking a bit before about what does craft really mean in cinema. And I think it's I mean, yes, there's a look, there's a feel to operating a Cook lens. You know, the team call it stiction, in terms of that that feeling of how the lens barrel rings turn when you're changing the iris or the focus. That perfect level of resistance that gives you confidence. And it's also, it's confidence that you will be able to find things precisely. And I think it's also a great team effort by the team, that you go from the optical designers, the mechanical designers, the what we call the MPI, new product introduction engineers, and everybody plays a role in kind of handing that process through to the people then that go, okay, right, I've got my recipe, now we know how to build it. But everything's done to incredibly tight tolerances. Things like the focus is calibrated. Every focus ring, so it has all the different marks for the different distances. Every lens that we manufacture, that's not a generic set of measurements or marks on the lens. Every lens is measured individually, because it's gone through a handcrafted process, so there's going to be variation in it, and that's just part of manufacturing. But to compensate for that, things like the focus marks are hand measured on a device, marked out, and then laser engraved. So each lens is a unique piece of art, functional art, or a functional luxury item, shall we say. And that tolerance is 5 microns.
Yeah.
You know, so width of a human hair. In terms of when you say it, when it's focused to like 20 feet, it's 20 feet to within, that 5 microns.
So when I was in the studio or store in London, there were images of some of the stills from films.
Yeah.
And there's this thing about perspective that Cook does. Is that right, or do we need to cut this bit out? That you could have a front and kind of the front. You could have two things in perspective at the same time, or two things focused at the same time.
I think you might be thinking of the focus exhibit,
right?
And there would have been discussion of split diopters and things like that. So, okay.
What is that?
Split diopter is where an extra glass element is put in front of a lens, so that it will either change the focus farther or closer, so that you could have two people at a distance from each other, both in focus, which wouldn't, depending on the T-stop, have actually been realistic. But for a storytelling point, wanting to have those two things be in focus to each other was a storytelling choice, and therefore that's when they put the extra bit of glass in front.
And which film is the most obvious that you would see that in?
I couldn't name one off the top of my head, other than the technique was recreated in Toy Story 4.
Okay.
For one of the sections in the antique store.
Okay.
And it was sort of like a great reference to that technique overall.
Oh, okay. So there you go. So Toy Story 4 is an animation.
Yes.
So that brings us to a digital lens then, doesn't it, obviously?
Yes. Yeah.
So explain how a digital lens works, because that's obviously very... Is it different, completely different to a... physical lens for...
It's a nuanced question. It's a great one, though. So the fundamental ideas of lenses are the same. What I'd say is that for cost and complexity, a lot of the techniques that have historically been used in animation, games, and visual effects rendering are more approximations rather than digital simulations. Because you can, yes, put glass elements, and you could push light wave-based information through them. You could apply, the effect of coding so that each glass element subtracts the right kind of wavelengths. All that can happen, but it's so cost prohibitive in terms of the rendering, the computational resources required for it, it's not practical. Mm. So over time, there's been a range of techniques that have come into play whereby the field of view or the focal length is recreated one way, Then the out of focus characteristics of a lens are created another way. And so along the way, you end up at something that acts and behaves like a lens, or it's lens-ish, but it's not a full virtual lens.
Yeah, because in the old days, animation was all drawn.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is quite a jump to then think, well, there's even a lens involved.
Yes,
a digital lens involved.
Well, I think once 3D animation, through the efforts of, folks like Pixar and DreamWorks and whatnot, really took off. And as the technology and the processing power increased, it's more and more being part of what people incorporate. Mm. And I think a lot of people that are involved in animation, are filmmakers. And, they just use different tools to tell their stories. And it's... and as the technology and the computational power increases, those two worlds are starting to really get very close to each other.
Yeah. So do you have a design philosophy? I mean, around, how you approach lens design for different medium?
I think it comes down to, at the end of the day, it's create a lens that creates a compelling story that tells emotions. Or allows the cinematographer to engage emotions, make it with quality, make it with robustness, making sure that it basically is a tool for the cinematographer. And it's the last thing that they need to worry about. Mm. And it's the first thing that influences their opinion.
Yeah. I mean, that's an important point, the first thing that influences their opinion.
Yeah. Because it's the first thing that... Whatever has happened with lighting and set design and the acting and everything else like that, the light waves that that go through the lens, that's the first thing that, like I said, it registers an opinion. It starts cutting and shaping light, light rays before it hits the camera sensor. Mm. It's their first tool along the way to creating that final image.
Mm. And I mean, this thing around how we see film. Mm-hmm. As a spectator, depending on the film you go to see, I mean, there's the luxury of that image that comes mm-hmm. through the lens.
Yes.
I mean, that's the cinematography, isn't it? And different levels, different kind of approaches to cinematography, whether it's, Steven Spielberg doing the shadows in the new West Side Story. I mean, that was quite an extraordinary piece of cinematography.
Yeah.
How would you think of the luxuriousness of all of this? What do you think of it? Do you think of it as being luxurious or luxury in any way?
I think the only parallel that comes to mind for all this is luxury in filmmaking, from my opinion, is having the time and the resources to create something with the least amount of compromise. So you could do everything from filming something with a mirrorless camera, a digital SLR, all the way up to working with a multi-100,000-pound professional high-grade cinema camera from Sony or from Arri or Red. So partly the luxury is, what tools do you have at your disposal and what freedom do they give you in the process?
And that's why this conversation is quite interesting, because I think most people wouldn't really think, I mean, you don't think of that as being within that context. And the no compromise is a luxury thing through anything, whether it's manufacture of a automotive manufacturer or aeronautical manufacturer, but it also obviously applies within film.
Yeah.
The no compromise. What is the no compromise? Is this a trick question?
Well, no, I think it's again, it's trying to find the nuance of not giving the same answer, but the no compromise is reducing the number of things that you have to worry about in the process of telling the story.
Right.
Right? So if you don't have to compromise on, so let's use an example, a complete unknown. That was shot with the Sony professional cine cameras. They have incredible light sensitivity, low noise. So luxury there was not having to carry around a ton of lighting equipment. There was interviews with the cinematographer where he talked about basically being ready to roll, and everybody thought the set was so dark that they're like, what about the lighting? He's like, oh no, we're good to go. And so that is a luxury of not making lighting get in the way of the actor's performance and slowing down the process and keeping it an organic set. Another way to look at it is same idea, the creator, because of the sensitivities of the small cameras, for them the luxury was being able to roll camera very quickly, be very opportunistic, travel light, not need a lot of lighting equipment because of the sensitivity of the cameras, and with minimal equipment turn out a beautiful sci-fi film.
So how much knowledge then does the director need to have about the tools they're using?
I think that's really up to the director and what and who they choose as collaborators.
Right.
I think it's hard to be a director that knows everything. Of course, there I think there are some, and they probably have come from a craft level where they have had their hands on the tools, and therefore they have some intrinsic knowledge of it. I think the requirement isn't there, because I think there are a lot of people that are specialists, and so you wouldn't hire a cinematographer. You wouldn't be a director and then hire a cinematographer if you knew everything else and you just needed somebody to just manage the crew.
Mm-hmm.
Again, maybe a luxury spin of that is having the budget and the appeal to get all the best collaborators.
Mm-hmm. So the cinematographer is the key.
I think they are a major player, but I think it would be a disservice to say costume design, production design.
No, I get it. But just in terms of realizing the visual effect, it comes from the cinematography.
Right. They are the final arbiter of that.
Yeah.
Right. So everybody else has kind of builds up layers of there's actually something to photograph. Then you end up obviously with a cinematographer and their team adding in the lighting on top of it, setting the mood, the actors doing their performance, and then, but yeah, the buck stops with the cinematographer in terms of the cameras pointed in the right direction, doing the right things at the right time to get the best footage that tells the story that the actors and directors were putting together.
Yeah. So, I mean, just going back to the craft thing, with this whole team that you're describing, just creating that visual language is obviously a skill that transcends to the whole the whole crew. How closely involved are you as the lens provider, or how much do you get involved in the production, the entire production of a film, or are you working with a few key people who are involved? Do you meet the actors? Do you meet the the general production crew, the costume designers?
No, I'd say our role is a bit removed from that level. We are interacting with cinematographers, typically not about an individual project. It's more about the trajectory of their needs in the future and what's worked for them in the past. And on the optical side, but on the digital side, I think we're much more involved in talking with the production crews and helping them understand what are the steps that they need to do to capture the right information so that this facilitates that sort of shared communication with the post-production side of the project.
Yeah, give us a synopsis about what the digital lens is as opposed to what the physical lens is.
Well, I think there's a couple sides to this. One is that there is a digital component to the optical lens, which is we have the sensors in the lenses that tell the camera everything that they were doing for every frame captured. And that could be as simple as the focus distance shows up on a monitor so that the DP and camera operators can see how it's changing and things like that. It could also then play through into how is that information shared between on-set production and the visual effects. And that's a lot of key information. If you think about things like, let's say you use Guardians of the Galaxy, Marvel, spectacular, lots of digital characters, things like that. So when you have this blend of shot footage and post-visual effects additions, the things that are added, if given that focus is a key cinematography technique, if the focus is changing, then the things that are added into the scene need to go through those focus changes in the same way. If that is taking place on a green screen or a blue screen, the person that is, or people that are then doing that work, if they don't have the information that's recorded by our lens sensors or other means, then all they have to go on is some notes from set and then basically flipping through frames, like literally just kind of squinting. Okay, I think the focus starts changing here. Looks like it goes there. Okay, then I think it ends here. And then they try and recreate that. But the nuance might be that there might have been blocking where the main actors kind of has to navigate through the set. So they stay in focus, but there's little shifts of back and forth as they sort of move through depth in their blocking that the focus puller would have been tracking. So there's levels of nuance that the visual effects team might not have been able to recognize because they're not given enough visual cues to see it. So what we're doing is helping bring to the industry the next evolution, which is making sure that this information about what happened on set is captured, almost sort of, it's metadata, but it, taking that sort of very technical, geeky term off it, just rephrasing it as, or rebranding it as, it's the cinematographer's love letter to the post-production team.
Right.
Because then it's like, hey, look, I can't be with you to tell you everything we did, but here's a list of all the choices we made on set, and hopefully this will help you make the images we all want to make together.
Right. So I've been in a post-production facility, and I was watching them grading a sky and looking at the shot that they, the physical shot of the beach and the sky.
Yeah.
And then they filmed the next day and then the weather wasn't the same. So they had to reproduce the sky from the day before so that everything was consistent. Does the digital lens, I mean, these might be completely ridiculous questions. Does the digital lens then facilitate that? Is there a connection?
So, well, absolutely. Right. So there are, I think some of these techniques in terms of like how easy it is to have all this information and to use it is something that we're working on. And we've got a lot of partners in the industry that are also working on this from movie labs down the SMPTE and then to other individual manufacturing companies. So the answer is yes. And if, to use your example, if in the scene that was the reference, the sky was in focus, but in the scene that they put the new sky into, the sky should have been out of focus, then knowing how to make it, how it should be out of focus, and therefore having access to virtual lens characteristics that would then just kind of be the shorthand of going, right, well, if it was that lens and that was supposed to be out of focus, this is how it would look. Mm. The future of that is it saves the artist from having to understand all the nuances. And you know, I mean, there's that 10,000 hours to mastery idea. And it's different for a cinematographer, I think, who spends their life looking through lenses.
Yeah.
And so they have built-in understanding and expectations of what that would look like. Other people who haven't been exposed to lenses in the same way will try and always do their best, but they may not understand the nuance of what's important to the cinematographer.
So how do you, as Cook Optics, how do you keep the industry, kind of how do you keep everybody kind of level, I suppose, in terms of both the analog and the digital, and bringing them together to make sure that, you know, everyone's in tune and knows what's going on because the things are changing. You spoke about, you mentioned earlier that the lenses have sensors in them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that a new thing? Because surely the lenses from 30 years ago didn't have sensors in them. It's changing. It seems to be changing quite quickly. And you seem to be at the kind of forefront of the change.
I'd say, that, all right, it's a very interesting question again. The and this is where I think it's... it goes to show that, you know, what effort needs to be applied to this. So Cook has actually been shipping lenses with the sensors in it, and the lenses for the last 20 years.
Wow, okay.
So the first S4i would have shipped in 2005. So it's been around for a while, and people would have seen sort of the impact of, okay, when you're on a set and you have that, again, more people are privy to what's going on in the lens because they can see the readout of the T-stop and the focus distance. The value of that information to the post-production team, again, through this divide over time, has not really manifested. So even though the technology started 20 years ago and the idea of metadata has been something very consistent in terms of its value to post-production visual effects, it's not... common knowledge about, you know, the needs of both sides and the opportunity on both sides. So the answer to the question of how do we deal with that? Of late, in the last couple of years, it's putting a real renewed effort into communicating with cinematographers, camera operators, focus pullers, post-production companies, to make them understand they have in their means the ability to capture something that will save their collective effort, that being them and the post-production teams, time and money, and ultimately end up in a better looking film. And given that everybody is kind of, well, for the most part, the key creatives, their ability to sell themselves for the next project is about how they did on the last one. And it's partly the relationships they build, and it's partly the images that they make. So everybody has a vested interest in making the best images possible. So it's just trying to build understanding. And we do that through the events that we have at our space, articles on the web, attending conferences that are either both visual effects and cinematography focused, or cinematography focused or visual effects focused.
I want to touch upon luxury branding and advertising.
Okay.
Do they use Cook lenses in advertising?
Yes,
they do. Because so they've completely different worlds. I mean, although they, you know, adverts are telling a story, I mean, typically luxury brands are very, you know, they're bright and in your face. They're not, you know, it's not this, it's not the same storytelling. You know, it's very seldom very moody.
Yeah,
it's much more, you know, abrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're selling a you know, they're selling a product or a service.
Yeah.
Is there a difference in the approach that you take when you're working with somebody in advertising as you would in film? And does that have an impact on the way you, I don't know, create different lenses, or is it the same sort of thing?
It's one. I mean, our role with advertising is definitely kind of removed and sort of behind. I would say that the cinematographer and their choices are at the forefront of that. So the question is, when it comes to the advertising, do the aesthetics of our lenses, one way or the other, sort of create the right atmosphere? And I'd say that we've got a series called the S8 that have been very popular in that because they have a very much of a beauty look to them, the way that they treat the skin tones and the smoothness, but they're still sharp. They can also be very stylized and out of focus in terms of like how quickly they fall off. So they get used in fashion and beauty related pieces. Another one of the most famous series that was shot with it was Emily in Paris.
Right. And which is very bright.
very bright, very beauty, you know, every character looks amazing, sharp. And, you know, they're all like, you know, beautiful people having beautiful adventures in a beautiful city. So it fits that. So the answer is, you know, we aren't doing things that are tailored to one particular thing or the other, but as we have a range of tools that have, that create different atmospheres, then cinematographers that are in those worlds of advertising and luxury, they can choose what they do. We've got macro lenses that are absolutely fantastic, that if someone was shooting a watch ad, you know, they would be a top-notch choice for shooting, you know, those sort of kinds of things. We've got one client that has a motion control robot and our macro lenses, and that's kind of the work that he does.
And do you, I mean, thinking about luxury brands and and fashion, Emily in Paris, I mean, that's all about trend. So do you, I mean, do the lenses change according, can you change the lens according to a trend or kind of a cinematic or cinematography?
Where I'd say fashion is like
something,
you know, if you scaled it like tortoise and hare, I'd say that a lot of trends in the worlds of consumer products and whatnot operate on a hare speed kind of trend, you know, course correction. The amount of time it takes to build, design, build, and then deliver lenses, we evolve at a much slower pace. And I think we're more of a storied brand where we're more considered in what we do. We're not trying to flip between trends. What I'd say is we, you know, we try and set trends where possible. My colleagues did a fantastic job with a lens called the SP3, where we were the first to take cinema-grade optics and repackage it into a smaller form factor that was initially intended to sort of support documentary cinematographers, things like that, shooting on more mirrorless form factor cameras. And those have become incredibly popular with mainstream cinematographers. A great example is the TV series Adolescence on Netflix, shot with a Cook SP3 lens. So we set that trend, right? And now other people are actually following along. And I think that's more of Cook's history, is being considered enough to understand the real opportunity that hasn't been answered yet, and then do it. And then people quickly follow along.
So what's the kind of, what's next? I mean, how do you continue innovating?
I think it's a great question. One I ask myself every day. I think it's really the time to spend with people. I think the, you know, when you understand someone's needs and you can start to, you have enough conversations, you can start to go, okay, you know what? These, you know, multiple things are aligned. And that is where you start to find, to quote our CEO, find the gaps in the market and the markets in the gap. So I think it's just spending time caring about the people that use our tools.
It's interesting because a lot of this conversation has been about craftsmanship. It's been about time. It's been about paying attention to detail. All of those things are kind of personified in luxury, and I wonder if people take this notion of filmmaking for granted, because, you know, how many people, it's just, I think it's with anything, isn't it, how many people when they go to the cinema think, oh my god, there are nine, well, when you see the credits you see 9,000 people on the credits, but I wonder how many people think about the craft that goes into, you know, selecting a lens, you know, which is what we're talking about. And portraying that image on a film that captures exactly what it is that the storyteller is trying to capture.
I think the only parallel that comes to mind for me is that I think a lot of people, they can enjoy it. They know when a story made them feel something, or that that action film was a great reason to turn off, you know, what was bothering them and on their mind for a couple hours. And
And I'd say that for the majority of people probably don't understand what it goes into making that. And I think that's the part of the distress that people feel around things like generative AI, because it takes something that has taken years to build, and what people don't see is all that effort, and it's distilled down into a little prompt now, and then makes a compelling image. And so the parallel I would say is that everybody can see and recognize a Mercedes, a Ferrari, Jaguar car when it's driving down the road. But they won't have, unless they're a real car aficionado, they won't really understand the difference between them. They won't have intrinsic knowledge of all the choices and effort that went into one car's engine versus another, or what makes them special, or why is it that they cost so much other than people paying for the name. So I think all across all luxury goods, I think there's the understanding of the appeal, the understanding of where it fits in the market, but very, I would hazard a guess that in across most luxury, there isn't a real understanding of the craft unless someone is personally so invested in it. And that's what they actually, why they buy into that particular thing is because they have an understanding of the craft and they appreciate it.
Yeah. And that's the challenge we face.
Yeah.
And that's why we have these conversations, because most people don't appreciate that there is somebody behind the thing that they're buying. Mm-hmm. The detail. You know, the skill that is learned, you know, you mentioned the 10,000 hours. Yeah. You know, most people don't appreciate that for anything. That's why it's important to have the conversations, because in this world of, you know, mass consumption of everything, mm-hmm. It's important to remember that, you know, these craft skills, you know, of your lens makers, of the cinematographers, you know, AI is not going to, you know, it's not going to replace it, even though everybody's saying it is. But you can't I might, you know, be proved wrong in a few years' time. You're not going to be able to reproduce the thing that somebody who has an eye.
Yeah, I think it averages a lot of things. And right. I think, like, to give you an example, so camera teams, you end up with, one person's typically could be moving the camera. Another person in some scenarios might be actually pointing the camera. A third person is then focusing the camera. And then a person by the name of the DIT, digital image technician, could also then be working on controlling the exposure as needed. So there's a whole team of people just to make a frame, right? And that's just the camera lens part of it, right? Then there's a separate subgroup of people that is putting the physical infrastructure around how that thing is moved. There's a separate group of people that are putting all the work into how it is all lit. And just even the idea of focus and how all that comes together and all that group of people. Like if you think about, we talked about like how an actor might be sort of in their blocking, moving, they're not going to move in a straight line. They might be moving in an arc. They might be moving through in a bit of a zigzag. The whole idea of how that actor is then kept in focus, what part of them is kept in focus? What was the T-stop? What was the cinematographer's intent for how much they're in focus versus how much the background's out of focus? The organic nuance of you know, the fact that it's not always perfect. And this is something that came up a lot in computer animation when it got started, was that because you didn't have this organic sort of play back and forth between multiple people, you could just go, it's in focus here, 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 and here, and you can make it perfect. Mm. Perfect is boring. Mm. And so I think part of the craft, part of the luxury is in that humanness and the imperfection that comes with it. And the counterpoint is you look at cameras now, autofocus on the rise, mirrorless cameras delivering that ability. There's a difference in that play of the technology versus the craft.
Mm. So did you see 1917? The film.
Oh, the Roger Deakins shot, World War One.
All the oneer.
Yeah, that was supposed to be all one take kind of thing. Yeah.
And was it all one take?
No.
Oh, okay. Because, I mean, if it was, that would have been quite extraordinary.
I think they did long stretches, but they definitely had strategic moments where they stitched it together and knew how to how to break it across.
Yeah, because I mean that was extraordinary. Just in the way the actors were tracked.
Yeah,
backwards, forwards, sideways through the trenches.
Yeah,
you couldn't do that in AI.
No, and just even like. I think it was 1917 versus All Quiet on the Western Front, but there was one point where a stunt performer went early or went late. But anyways, the main act, no, it was 1917. The main actor, he was running across parallel to the trench. Mm. An extra came up and over, collided. They fell down. He got back up and kept running. And it was so expensive. Like they could have stopped to say, no, that's not what was supposed to happen. But it was so expensive to reset, they just kept going.
Right.
And in the end, that was actually the best thing for the film.
Right.
And so they kept it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, this whole element of luxury that is, like everything else, is, you know, it's masked, it's cloaked, and you just don't see it. And I think, you know, it's so important, I think, to expose what happens, you know, whether you're a lens maker, whether you're a bag maker. Yeah. And I was wondering what does the future hold for you? Where do your interests lie in terms of filmmaking, a cook?
I think we're interested in, I mean, there's a big shift. There's a lot of phrases or terms can be used: the democratization, the availability, the pulling down barriers, things like that. But I think there's a lot more people making images these days, and cameras are in many more places. The ability to for someone to create an incredible audience and broadcast on a platform like YouTube creates a lot of opportunities, and so I think. Looking across that and high-end cinema and whatnot, and just trying to track where can we help with that storytelling? Yeah. We're already sort of serving that YouTube market through things like our SP3 lenses. And I think it's interesting, I do consider it luxurious that it's the idea of personalized content. Yeah. And so you have, if you go through some of the people that are tracking the creator economy and YouTube and whatnot, there are channels I've never heard of that have millions of followers, that have a seven-figure sort of revenue. And so I think it's incredibly amazing that we can now have so much content curated, you know, and available on any one topic. My son was starting to sort of build out resumes and found a whole range of resume influencers and whatnot that are all creating content and all have a business on the side. I think where things are interesting is what's going to happen. And I'm sort of looking at this from a very London lens. And that is what's happening with cinema. You look at these sort of mass cineplexes are fewer in number. The cinemas that are available tend to lean into a bit of the experience. The luxury seating has changed over the years. There's cinemas like the Prince Charles Theater, which is amazing for seeing a whole curated set of classic cinema. And then you can go into these beautiful cinemas that are, luxury leather seats, or in the case of something like Everyman, you've got these sofas with people bringing you drinks in the bar right to your seat, that sort of thing. And then IMAX is doing fantastic with what they're doing with their experience. So I think the cinema experience itself is, I think, going that luxury way as well.
But also now, there's an increased use of 35 mil again.
Mm-hmm. Film production being a luxury of for the filmmaker. But at the same time, I've been listening to a few discussions about film actually being a really great creative tool, simply because it is a finite resource. You just can't keep rolling. It's not just another hard drive that you can just, you know, plug into the camera. And so that, on one hand, it's a luxury because it comes with a budget or a much higher budget. But at the same time, when it focuses everybody on set, it just might create a better film.
Yeah. Well, there's a luxury in that.
Yeah.
What is your luxury?
Great question. Time. I think reaching the point where I'm in, you know, very fortunate to love what I do. It has a lot of demands on time. So I think time with family, you know, got an 18-year-old that's going to be off to university soon. Time for hobbies, time for just enjoying the world. That's, you know, kind of my luxury, I would say. Love nothing better than getting up, being able to, like, see the sunrise, see the sunset, just enjoy the beauty of the world. I mean, that's my luxury.
Perfect. Jordan, thank you very much for chatting to me on the Pursuit of Luxury podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Jordan, for joining us. Thank you to our hosts, Henry's Townhouse in Marylebone, London. Thank you for listening. And don't forget, you can catch all previous episodes of the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast on your favorite listening platform. For all other exciting things happening at In Pursuit of Luxury, go to inpursuitofluxury.com, where you'll find information about our executive training taking place in London and Zurich, our conference that's happening in London in September 2026, and also our journal, which is published twice a year.
And if you're watching after the edit, you know, this was a magic coffee that just appeared.